pull the shear a little short, but with two people it should run a little bit faster. It's always important to, when you start a new safer, to analyze who wrote it, to analyze the overall structure of the safer, just to get an idea of where the safer is going, where the safer, how the safer is built. And the third one is to figure out why the safer is built. Usually when you put A and B together, that is who wrote it and how did they write it, you usually figure out what the goal was of the author in penning the book. So Chazal make it easy for us, right, to start with. Chazal say in Bava Batra that the author is none other than Shmuel HaNavi. Of course, that presents a certain problem, because Shmuel HaNavi wasn't around for a lot of the stories that take place in Shoftim. So the question is, there's always a question when we say a Navi authored a book. So of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that they authored the book. More often than not, what it really means is that they redacted the book from previous writings. That is, there's probably a certain amount of their own nebuah going on if it's current events. But if it's previous events, then it's usually other prophets' works that were passed down prophet to prophet, as in Masorah, and compiled by Shmuel. Shmuel actually had the advantage of setting up a prophet house. He actually trained prophets in his city, I think it was Ramatai and Sophim, created a house of prophets that David ran away to, and that Shaul tried running away to. He had a whole prophet and training type of school. And so it wouldn't be surprising that a lot of documents came to
him.
Chevel Nevi'im, well, that really predated Shmuel. Well, they probably belonged to Shmuel, I would guess. He certainly knew who they were, or knew about them. He expected them to be there. When Shmuel tells Shaul, go and you'll find a Chevel Nevi'im, there's two possibilities. One is he's having just a pure vision. And the other thing is he knows that they're going to be there. The question is the interaction. What's the interaction going to be?
No, right. But I'm just saying, the Chevel Nevi'im, we talk about, the central training, was Shmuel the only one that trained the Nevi'im, or did they have these, the Nevi'im that were already trained, like the Chevel Nevi'im, and people, some people would say it was familial, some people inherited the Nevi'im.
Right. Well, in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, it says Ein Chazon Nefrat. So actually, the concept of Nevuah really almost completely died out. Eli had a little bit, but not much. Not much was going on. So really, Nevuah had died out by the end of Sefer Shoftim to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. Probably the Chevel Nevi'im were trained by Shaul. I think that's like our Masorah, is that he trained the whole new generation of Nevi'im. So they all belonged to him, really. He was sort of like, created a Harvard type of system. It doesn't necessarily, that we're not forced into that. You could say once the Nebuah came back during Shmuel's time, that other people successfully got it as well. So we don't know for sure that the Chevel Nevi'im were not related to Shmuel. But we do know that before Shmuel started having Nebuah, there was no Nebuah for quite a period of time. As we'll see in Sefer Shoftim, what really happens is, and it's part of the structure of the book, is that after a certain point, after a certain judge, there is no more Nebuah. It really disappears. The Shoftim themselves are weak, sometimes downright evil. They're not religious leaders. They're, if anything, military leaders, and sometimes not very good leaders. The concept of prophecy, like that you have with Devorah and Gidon, where the sort of the pièce de résistance of Shoftim, really disappears completely. So probably right after Gidon is that when everything started going downhill. But that's something that we'll cover during the course of the coming weeks. So Shmuel didn't write the book word for word. He redacted the book based on previous prophecy. It had its own little fill. I think really the trick is that a prophet was smart enough to know. I think the prophet really had two things. One is that he was able to hear prophecy, or at least see images or something that he could translate, and knew that it was important to get the message across. But the second is, I think he was a good judge of books. I think that a prophet had the ability to look at a text and say, yes, that's a prophetic text, rather than that's just a historical book. We have historical books. Yoshua talks about, when it says, Shemesh b'givon dom v'yareach v'aimek yalom, when Yoshua stops the sun, it says, Halo hi tuval sefer ha-yashar. Isn't it written in Sefer Yashar? Now the Medrash tells us that what that really means is Sefer Yashar is Bereshit, and that means it was foretold in Bereshit. But the Radak there, as well as others, simply say that they had books which were non-prophetic. They were a Divrei Hayamim of sorts.
Like Chronicles.
Chronicles. And because they were not prophetic, they were copied down haphazardly, which it really goes to the whole issue of the apocryphal writings. The apocryphal writings mostly were written by Jews. The Book of the Maccabees, the Book of Enoch, the Book of Adam, wasn't it? Ben-Sira. Ben-Sira actually probably is a better copy, because at least Ben-Sira is quoted by Chazal.
Right.
Now, even though Ben-Sira has some pretty funny stuff in it, Chazal actually felt that the wisdom was reasonably well and good enough to actually quote. It was a very popular text. Other books like the Maccabees were lost completely. We only have the, I think we found the Greek versions or African versions. Same with the Book of Enoch, same with books about Solomon, books of Adam, all kinds of interesting. There's actually a book called Sefer Yichus Moshe, which tells about Moshe's story, which is where the Rashbam gets the idea that when it's talking about Moshe with the Isha Kushit, that it's actually that Moshe during the 60 lost years that he's wandering around in the desert, we don't know what happens to him, that he actually went down to Eretz Kush and he created a relationship, and then from that relationship you have Malkat Shavah, and you have this whole Jewish-African kind of lineage which is set up. Now what's funny is the Ibn Ezra says, ignore the whole thing. He says he's familiar with the Sefer Yichus of Moshe, and he says forget it, it's not reliable, because essentially what you had with these non-prophetic books is that they were not kept meticulously like the prophetic ones. And therefore, the recopying, first of all, you weren't sure about whether it was really a solid story in the first place. Second of all, you don't know whether what you had was a viable, they didn't have the printing press, you didn't know whether you had was a viable copy. People stick in whatever they want. I actually was reading in India, I think it was India, they have this there's a religious group that reads poetry. They have this one epic poem that's been going on for about 2,000 years. And every generation adds its own stuff to the poem. And that's part of the religious value. So it gets longer and longer. It takes 3 days to say, and it's, hi, how are you?
Hi.
Hello. So it takes like 3 days to say it's an entirety. When you don't have a solid prophecy that's copied down letter for letter, then you have a dilution, or you have additions, you have all kinds of weird things going on. Shmuel, so first of all, Shmuel had these documents which were kept, but also I think he was able to distinguish fairly well, because he came after a very dark period in Jewish history, which we'll get into. You're looking for Shulchan? For Yeshua Shulchan? I'm talking for you. And there's probably a few more, by the way, if you need.
There was one I did find.
There might be in the pink book.
There is one. I didn't find the answer, but I found the show.
Can I ask a question? I want to be careful about this question, because I don't want to mean to be rude. Does everybody think that the Beit Medrash program starts at 8, goes from 8 to 9?
I was
not clear.
This class
has always been
8
to
9. 8 o'clock.
Right.
But with the Beit Medrash, I don't know when that's supposed to be starting, and I don't know what the time is. Right. Oh, you started at 7:30?
We were here at 7:30.
Well, we started at 7:30, but then aren't you glad we hung around? We weren't sure whether there was nobody coming.
Yeah. So we had a hunch that 8 o'clock people would show up.
We had the hunch that 8 o'clock.
It's 8 o'clock.
Yeah, well, that's what I say. I thought
she's not here. Did you see her?
No, I didn't see her.
Well, when I called Ann Dershowitz last night to ask about that, because it was confusing, they gave me to understand that today it was still the 8 o'clock. And afterward, there's going to be the base measures starting.
Oh, so maybe
and
that regular base measure really starts next week.
Yes.
Next week.
And I don't know what time
today
is
our class, but not the rest of the
week. No wonder Tova's not here. Right.
So
next week, then, we're going to start at 7:30 then. The truth is, 8 o'clock is honestly a better time really for professionals.
Yeah.
The problem is Rich wanted to move it to 7:30 so that the rabbi doesn't have to speak to 10 o'clock, because he feels that people get wasted for the second sessions. Mm-hmm. So bowing to that, we moved to 7:30.
Oh, mm-hmm. So then that's the whole explanation. Starting next week, it will be the
at
7:30 to 8:30.
The only I don't want to pull anybody away from the rabbi, Chas V'Shalom.
Well, what time is this?
This starts at 8:30 to 9:30.
Oh,
so I don't want to. I think I would need to start at 7:30. Okay. Either that, or just get a half an hour shear, which probably I can only introduce myself in a half an hour. So
you can't usually stop in an hour, let alone a half an hour.
Sorry, it's
no,
true.
I'm not saying.
It's true in the high school also.
But I know
that
it's one of those.
The other question is, I mean, if anybody here intends to
Are you going to be able, is there anybody here who's not going to be able to make it because it's 7:30?
I mean, it's hard for me. I get out of work. I can't shake from work.
The only thing I can imagine is that it's switching to
look,
rabbi.
No.
But I don't know if I need to go on from 8:30 to 9:30. I don't know if I can do that.
Yeah,
all right,
let's don't worry about it. Yeah, you know.
Okay, let's see. Okay, so in analyzing the book of Judges, I can quote you the Gemara, which says that Shmuel wrote it. And there's even a hint that Shmuel wrote it, because there's some similar words used in the book of Shoftim that are used when Shmuel is giving his dress-down speech to Bnei Israel, who just asked Shmuel to appoint the king. He uses very similar words. I don't want to get into those words right now, because you can see a little textual comparison. The truth is, though, the proof, it is absolutely clear after learning the book of Shoftim that Shmuel wrote it. However, it's not really provable from this point. At this point, I would say that it really can only be proven, if anything could be proven on these 3,000-year-old issues, it can only really be proven after a study of Sefer Shoftim. So right now, I'd just like to tell you Shmuel wrote it. I think by the time that we're halfway through the Sefer, we'll come to a realization that it can't be anybody else except for Shmuel, and we'll find out why he wrote it as well. But let's analyze right now a little bit why he wrote it. Now, Menachem Liebtag actually says something very interesting, which he says, it's of course a Rav Yolban, no idea, every Sefer has a goal. There's no reason to write a Sefer unless you have one unified goal. The way that Menachem proves that there is a goal is by pointing us to the second chapter of Sefer Shoftim. And I would suggest as a text, a Tanakh is probably your best bet for the class. If you have a Hebrew-English Tanakh, it's best. Certainly Hebrew-English Judges is a good bet. I have some printouts here to make things a little bit easier for tonight, but I'm uncomfortable printing all the Shemus out because it always comes out with Shemus. I'll try to print that as much as I can, actually. So in verse 6 of chapter 2, it says, Vayishlach Yoshua et ha'am, Vayachu b'nei Yisrael ish l'nachal atol v'reshet et ha'aretz. So Yoshua sends everybody to go conquer the land. And Menachem correctly says that what it is this verse 6 of chapter 2 really is where the book should have started. Because it's a direct continuation of the end of Sefer Yoshua. Yoshua is going to die. And it says, V'yishlach Yoshua ta'am v'yachub b'nei Yisrael ish nachal atol resh ta'am. And now, for the next, till the end of chapter 2, you have this what's called the cyclical nature of Sefer Shoftim, which is the people go to their lands. They start to intermingle with the non-Jews in Eretz Yisrael. They start to worship the Avodah Zarah of the non-Jews that are still in Eretz Yisrael because they haven't conquered them. God sends a punisher to punish Eretz Yisrael, a foreign nation to punish Eretz Yisrael. The people realize what they have done wrong. They pray to God, and God sends them a shofet to save them. And then the whole cycle starts again. They get saved for a while. Sometimes in a good situation, like Devorah, you get a good save for 40 years. Sometimes you get saved for maybe a year or two before everything goes bad. But there's this constant cyclical nature of the book of Shoftim. He proves, in fact, that the Sefer starts here, technically, from a sort of a didactic purpose, by pointing out to us that the first chapter starts with, look at how the first chapter starts with, Vayhi acharei mot Yehoshua. After the death of Yoshua, Vayishalu b'nei Yisrael b'Hashem le'mor. So the people now can't turn to Yoshua, so they turn directly to God. Whether this is Urim Batumim, or whether it's the Navi of the time, who they're talking to exactly is a little unclear. But they turn to God because Yoshua's dead. They said, who should go? Mi alel ha'knani b'chila li'lachem ba. Who should fight first against the Canaanites to fight against them? So what he says is here, Yoshua and Pasuk Aleph is dead. In Perek Bet 6, Yoshua is alive and kicking. So therefore, essentially, it's like two starts of the Sefer. And this is also how Menachem stresses the idea, is that essentially Shmuel was working from previous documentation. He had prophetic works, he had a prophetic work of the first chapter, he had a prophetic work of the second chapter, and he tied them together in the way he thought would be logical. Menachem explains, and here I'm going to keep going with Menachem, so I'm going to disagree with him in a second. Menachem explains that the second chapter is really where the didactic purpose starts, and it's we see they sin and they're punished and they pray to God and they're saved and they sin and they promise and they punish, etc., over and over again until the end. The first chapter, Menachem says, is why it happens. So in the first chapter, you have very strange things. You have a series of wars. And it's really all about the fact, time after time, that each tribe was unsuccessful in a greater or lesser sense at conquering the land. They left the non-Jews in the land. And by leaving, by not going through with the total scorched earth policy against the non-Jews, they allowed intermarriage. Intermarriage led to idol worship. Idol worship led to punishment. Punishment led to, ultimately, prayer and redemption. Exactly what it says, by the way, right? Hazinu Hashemayim v'Adavar. There's a little piece which says, and you will leave the people of the land, and you will start to have kids with them, and you'll start to worship their gods, etc., etc. I think there's more going on, though, to the Sefer than just the fact that this is the setup of why everything turned bad. And chapter 2 starts with really the beginning of the Sefer, which says, and now let me tell you how things are going bad, and Shmuel's going to tell us how we're going to fix it. I think this doesn't completely see the full picture of the book. In order, I think there's something else that you need to look to whenever you look at a book of prophecy, which is the beginning chapters and the end chapters. Because the beginning and the end chapters of almost every book of prophecy are out of place. See, a lot of times, about how Sefer Yeshayahu doesn't start chronologically from the beginning. Chapter 6 is actually chronological beginning. So why start with what's so weird about Sefer Yeshayahu that he wants to start out of order? The truth is, nothing's weird about Yeshayahu. Almost every Sefer in prophecy starts or ends out of order. I'll give you an example. Yehoshua, at the end of Yehoshua, I don't want to prove it textually now, but again, this is why it's good to bring a Tanakh if possible. Yehoshua is essentially at the end of his life, and then the second to last chapter goes back in time to talk about the 2.5 tribes, Gad, Shevet, Menashe, and Reuben, and it starts to go through a whole story, which you can prove textually, I'm not going to take the time to do it now, but you can prove textually that it's earlier in Yehoshua's life. It's specifically out of place. Here, too, in Sefer Shoftim, there are two famous incidents which are completely out of place, which the book ends with. I'll tell you what they are now. We'll study them in depth a little bit later, but we'll touch on them now. The first one is the story of Michayahu. Michayahu had a bad, bad mother. He stole from his mother. And this is going to be very important. We'll get to why this is such a crucial story. And his mother curses him. She doesn't curse her son. She curses the person who steals her money. I curse the person who steals from me. I give them the worst curse. Michayahu is scared. So Michayahu goes to his mother and says, Ma, it was me. And then she says something very strange. She says, oh, Baruch B'ni LaHashem. Blessed is my son to God. There's a very weird mother-child relationship at the end of the Sefer, which is, by the way, when we get there in a few months, going to contrast versus the famous excellent mother-child relationship, which is, of course, Hannah and Shmuel. And we'll see the comparisons between the two, where they're sort of the evil twins of each other, and that's why that story is at the end. But everybody agrees that that story is taken out of place. We don't know when it took place, to be honest. Radak, Ralbag, Rashi, they all weigh in. Nobody's quite clear when that story takes place. The other story, of course, is the sort of the quintessential shock story at the end of Sefer Shoftim, which is Peleges Begibah. Where Peleges Begibah, Gibah, which is the city of the holiest tribe, essentially, the holiest tribe of Israel. I know it's supposed to be the Kohanim, but it's not. Binyamin is the only tribe that was born. Binyamin is the only native-born Israeli. He's the only Sabra. All of the Mishkans, I've done this before in previous Shirin, but I'll repeat it quickly. Every single Mishkan that we ever had, except for Yoshua Shiloh, was always in Binyamin's territory. North Yerushalayim, Givon, Gilgal, every single place of worship, including Yerushalayim, because the line for Yerushalayim is divided north-south, and Har Habayit is on the northern side, so it's actually in Binyamin's territory. Binyamin is supposed to be the quintessential holy tribe. At the very end of Sefer Devarim, we just read it. It says, "Yishkon levetach, Yedid Hashem, Yishkon levetach, Ben Tefav Yishkon. I shall dwell among his shoulders." And it's significant. And this supposedly this super tribe go down to the lowest possible level that you can imagine. I mean, it's shocking. It's tempting to ignore the story or to somehow figure out what's not going on, because essentially they do the same thing as Sodom and Gomorrah. The same story. Sodomy, rape, putting people out, death, murder, civil war. It's the worst. I mean, it's almost unheard of.
Well, they weren't alone.
What's that?
They weren't alone. They're in Israel, this is a different thing, too. And the guy who's the minister there was an animal.
The Levi, and we're going to get into that also. What happened to the Levi? By the way, both of those stories, again, Michayu and Levi, they're both stories about wandering Levi. Mm-hmm. Both of them.
It's clear that those Levi are really, you know, what kind of Levi are
they? They are actual Levi. They are actual Levi, but this, what's that? I think it's Ben Gershom, so we actually have some kind of descendants. I believe we know the Levi, but I'm not positive. But certainly the story is about people who are called Levi, and they have these wandering stories. There's a lot that ties those two stories together. But the most important thing is not analysis of the stories right now. It's the fact that both of those stories are out of place. Now, let's go to Sefer Shmuel. Sefer Shmuel, of course, not Alphabet, because there is no Alphabet. It's all Sefer Shmuel. Also ends off with a weird story about Dov and Amalek. We get pretty much, we're chronological all the way through Sefer Shmuel, except for the end, where we have the story where Vayomer David, a god Sarli Mo'od, he runs the census, the angel comes down, and David sees he's right over Harabayit, so he knows he has to buy the field from Arvana and build, and he knows that's going to be the famous Beit HaMikdash is. That's not at the end of David's life. That's not the end of David's life. It's chronologically out of order. So essentially, I think it's the norm that books are chronologically out of order. And it's very simple. It should make sense that these books, even though that they're narrative, they're chronologically out of order, because the goal is not historical. The goal is to make a spiritual point. So by forcing you into an out-of-chronology situation, it forces you to think about what the message is, because the message can't simply be a storytelling. So here what we have is chronologically something out of order at the end. That we've established in Sefer Shoftim, which will take us a while to get there. But now let's look at the beginning. See, this is where I disagree with Menachem a little bit. Because even if we go to chapter 1, and here's pretty much where we'll start the Sefer now, with that big introduction. Vayhi acharei mot Yoshua, vayishlu b'nei Yisrael emor, mi'al elanot k'nei b'tzilah li'lachem bo. So the way Menachem has it is from this pasuk until the sixth pasuk in the second chapter, it's all sort of in the future. It's current day Sefer Shoftim. Then in chapter 2 we'll do a little backtracking to when Yoshua is still alive, and then we'll come back forward. But that's not true. Something weird is going on. Within this single section, take a look please in pasuk go down to pasuk 10 in chapter 1. Vayelech Yehuda el HaKnani Hayoshev b'Chevron v'shem b'Chevron b'fanim Kiryat Arba v'aku et Sheshai Achiman v'etalmai. That didn't happen after Yoshua's death. As I'll show you soon, that happened while Yoshua was still alive. What's interesting, by the way, is the guy who conquered it is left out of the story for some interesting reason. The guy who conquered Chevron was none other than Kalev ben Yefune. And for some reason, that's not repeated. And yet, in the next pasuk, we have a sukkim that were repeated word for word from Sefer Yoshua. So not only do we have something which it's chronologically out of order within itself. That is, I start with Yoshua's death, and then by the 10th pasuk, I'm now 30, 20 years before Yoshua's death, within this very same place. But there's no sense of movement. I don't know that. Had I not read Sefer Yoshua, I would be completely in the blind. I would not know. Kalev was younger than Yoshua, so no reason to believe that he didn't live after Yoshua. I don't know that this is chronological order, but let's go ahead and read the story. Vayelech Misham el Yoshvei Dvir. He went to a place called Dvir, which is not too far from, it's in that whole South Israel area where Yehuda had received its territories. Vashem Dvir Lefanim Kiryat Sefer. It was called Kiryat Sefer. By the way, this is not the Kiryat Sefer that exists in Israel today, which is by Maccabim, it's by the Judah line. It's not the same Kiryat Sefer. It's much to the south of that. Vayomer Kalev Asher Yaked Kiryat Sefer. So Kalev, now Kalev all of a sudden comes back to the picture. He says, whoever conquers Kiryat Sefer, Ulukada, and conquers it, defeats it, Venatati lo tachsabi tili shah. And I give him my aksa, my daughter, as a wife. So we got a little bit of nepotism going on, right? So we're not exactly sure what the relationship is between them. We'll analyze it a little bit, but there's clearly they're related. This guy named Otniel ben Kenaz. So he goes and conquers it, and he takes Batitin Loet Asa Bitolisha. And then he gets his, I don't know, his aunt, his cousin, or whatever, however we want. He gets a close family relative as his wife. Vayehi bevoa, and then she comes to Kalev, Batisiteu l'shol me'eta via sadeh. She, that word, Batisiteu, lasit somebody, is like to instigate somebody. It's a rather negative word. And there's nothing really negative about the story, so it's sort of a weird word. Why use such a negative word? So the Chazal say that he didn't want to ask for what was about to be asked, and his wife forced him to. No bad things get done to wives, it's just this incident. Batisiteu l'shol me'eta via sadeh. She wanted new property that she wasn't getting. So batitznach me'alach hamor, also strange word. She leaps off her donkey. Very strange. Vayomer la Kalev malach, and Kalev says, "What is it?" But those words malach should remind you of something. Those words, what, are Esther also said? That's once. The only other time they're said is when Bathsheba is begging to have her son Shlomo recognize as the king. And she comes before a sick David, who's more than happy just to let the whole thing roll and to leave the whole thing over and let Adoniyahu become the king. And he says to her, Malach, also. That's going to be important, but I'll get there in a second. But Tomer lo havali bracha, give me a blessing. Here, it's a negative, Natati, in this lousy property. But Natati li gulot mayim, I want water. Vayitain la Kalev gulot ilit gulot. So Kalev gives the money. This story is weird in and of itself. There's no explanation here, Midrashim galore, but textually it's a weird story. The words are weird, the context is weird, we don't know what the goal is, it seems very strange, but the weirdest thing about it is, you've heard this story before. Sefer Yoshua, if you have these sheets, take a look at Sefer Yoshua, Perek Tetvav, which is the bottom section in this area, it's the last chapter. Vayiresh Masham Kalev et Shlosha Bnei Anak. Now, if you notice, the story is word for word, except in Yoshua tells us exactly who conquered Hebron. It was Kalev himself. Et Sheisha Yedachiman et Talmai Yubidei Anak. Vayal Misham al Yoshvei Tvir. This is word for word. Vayas Mishem Tvir Lefanim Kiryat Sefer. Vayom Kalev. Asher Yaked Kiryat Sefer Lekadav and Atati Ed Achsabi Tivisha. Word for word. Vayikadalat Niel Ben Knaz Afi Kateh, Afi Kalev. I don't say Akaton Mimeno. There are a few missing words. But by and large, at the same story, she jumps off the Chavor, Vatisiteo. It's a repeated story. The story is weird enough as it is. So why do I need to repeat a weird story twice? And what's more important is, I would understand what Malcolm's trying to say is that this all chapter one is happening after the death of Yeshua. But it's not. I've got a total time warp within this chapter one that would at least attest to be after Sefer Yoshua. Why repeat the story? Why take me on a time travel? Why repeat the weirdest story in Sefer Yoshua that's hard enough to understand as it is? Absolutely. Kalev is Kalev ben Yefuneh. Is his brother. Now the fact that Otniel ben Kenaz has a different name, so Chazal immediately saying, Rashi brings down, and everybody pretty much agrees, that they were related by mother. So Otniel's father's name was Kenaz, and Kalev's father's name was Ben Yefuneh. However, I don't know why they do this, and I'll tell you why. Take a look at the third section down in Sefer Bamidbar, when God is relating to Moshe that the only two people are going to get to go to Eretz Yisrael are Kalev and Yoshua. Look what it says. These people who went to the Meraglim, the whole generation is going to die out. They're not going to see the land. Because they didn't pay attention to me, God. There's the Kenaz. Probably, I don't know why the Midrashim, honestly I'm stumped. Because, believe me, Chazal knew how to read Sefer Bamidbar. They knew what was going on here. I would have guessed that Kenazi, very often your name, not after the name of your father, but after your familial name. And we have things like Chizkiyahu ben David and Yoshiahu ben David. Very often you go to like the family name. It appears quite clear here that Kenazi are some type of tribal name that Kalev belongs to. Why they had to create this story that Kenaz is not even related, that he's a father. I don't know why they created this relationship through the mother and not a tighter relationship. One reason is because if they really are from like brothers, then they're all kinds of weird. That means that he's marrying his niece. Now that's permissible. Not only that, it's even good. But maybe Chazal were uncomfortable with it. I don't know why they would be. I just have always had problems with this. I don't understand why Chazal had to go out of their way to create a non-direct relationship when Sefer Van Midbar clearly establishes Tnizi as a familial name for Kali as well. What's that? I don't know. Excellent question. If I was better prepared, I would know, because I don't think that Kanaz is the parent. I think if you backtrack through Kalev and Yifuna, I don't think you wind up with Kanaz. I don't think he shows up. But I'm going to skip that just for now and leave it as a Tzarech Iyum. One thing's clear, they're closely related. They're brothers, they're half-brothers. Either way, they're brothers. He's marrying his niece or his half-niece or whatever it is. But still, the story is a little unclear why things are going on. Yes.
He's a brother.
He was much younger. He was less than 20. Well, it says Achi Kalev Akatomi Meno, the brother of Kalev. Now, it's true the word Achi is sometimes used in a more relaxed manner. So it could be that it's not a direct familial relationship. But I have no problem putting Atmiel much younger, and I'll tell you why. Because the first prophets. Sorry, the first shofet of Sefer Shoftim starts in Perek Gimel, and it is none other than Atmiel ben Kenaz. He's the shofet of Eretz Yisrael. So not only does he have this whole inheritance thing, now we see that he actually takes over after Yoshua's death. So he's at least quite a bit young. So now I've established two things, and I haven't yet tied them together. I've established major weirdness at the beginning of the Sefer, plus chronological out-of-orderness. And at the end of the Sefer, we have chronological out-of-orderness as well. I'm sure these aren't real words. But now I want to tie together the beginning of the Sefer and the end of the Sefer. Yeah?
It says here, the son of Kinnah, that Atmiel and Sarah, the son
of. So then the question is, so wait a minute, and then it says, the son of Kinnah, who's the father of Yehuda? That's the question. So this is what? Ibn Kenaz? I think my guess is that it was a common name that was. It was probably. I'm not even sure what Kenaz means, to be honest. It was probably some type of family name that was sort of wafting around from family and family member. The fact that Yehuda's father is not Kenaz here probably forces Chazal into saying that they have brothers. Otherwise, where's the father of Yifuna, or even the grandfather of Kenaz? So that's probably what they were grappling with. However, I'm not going to get stuck on this issue, because what's important is to know that they're closely related, and you'll see why soon. Yehuda. Or Yehuda. Which is Southern Israel, yeah.
I was just looking at the comment for, the Mayamolei. They seem to lean towards the interpretation that, in fact, it was out of order in the Yeshua. The battle actually took place after the Yeshua's death,
okay,
and not before, and that the reason they brought it up in Yeshua is that it was through his merit that these victories actually took place. Even though he was already dead, it was through his merit that took place, and that's why it was first mentioned in Yeshua. They bring that up as a possibility that chronologically it did happen after his death that the cities were conquered.
Right, it's certainly possible. However, Debir, I believe, is one of the cities that's listed as the cities that were conquered by Yeshua. I think it's one of the 31 cities.
Right, it's mentioned there, and it's mentioned
so they conquered
there.
And then they reconquered it?
And they said it's obviously it didn't happen twice, so when did it happen? And there's two different points of view,
right,
as to whether this is out of order or that's out of order. And I don't know, it just seems to me to make sense. It's one way to say that they're both right. Is to say that it was mentioned there because it was in his merit, and he had so much to do with the, you know, it was because of him,
right,
that it was conquered, even though it wasn't done in his.
Then you get into a little religious problem, which is that Sefer Yoshua was then written by Sefer Yoshua plus add-ons at a later time.
True.
So that runs you into a little problem,
right,
than having Shmuel.
But right.
But not that that's impossible, by the way. Books do have, we know that the ends of the books are certainly written by other people, either Pinchas or Shmuel. So it's
right,
certainly possible that not in the Torah, but in the Nevi'im, there's a certain play that's possible to go with. But either way, whether Yeshua is chronically out of order, or as I prefer it, this is chronically out of order, I still need to understand what's going on. So here's where we need to pay attention to a very interesting word. What I'd have you do is take a look at Pasuk 2. Shmuel Shoftim Aleph, Pasuk 10. Sorry, Pasuk Aleph. Vayigiach Arimot Yoshua, Vayishalu Bnei Yisrael, Badunai Lemor, Niyale Lano Latnani, Bitzila Lehilachem Bo. Who is going to be the first to go up against the Tnani to conquer them? Now, if you have a Tanakh, please go to the story of Pilegus from Giba, where the 11 tribes come together to destroy Sefer Binyamin. And you'll see something very interesting. It would be in chapter, I'm guessing, Kaf. Hold on a second. It's right before the battle. It's right before the battle. It's where Yehuda decides to go up first. Just a second. It should be around Yudalid. I'm looking to show through. Yekum ve'alu be'zel. Yekum ba'boker. It's Yisrael nechamah ben'emin. It's Yisrael nechamah. You know what? You have one. Oh, there it is. Very good. Thank you. We'll start with 17. Just restructuring the idea. The Ish Yisrael Hitpaktu, all the Jews got together. Levad mi Binyamin, of course, to fight against Binyamin. Arba meot elef 400,000 shalat teravish mechamah. Ve'akumu ve'alu beitel, and they went to the house of God. Ve'yishalu be'elohim ve'yuru b'nei Yisrael. Mi yale lanu batchila le'milchamah in b'nei Binyamin. Ladies and gentlemen, it's sad. It not only is it a match, and by the way, look at the answer. What is the answer? Vayom Hashem Yehuda Batchila. It's textually exact. What the author has done, and I'll say Shmuel, but again, I'll prove it to you in a month or two from now. What the author has done is he's tied the weirdness of the first chapter to the weirdness of the last chapter. But honestly, he's done something which makes me want to cry. Look at the words. Yoshua's dead. He's gone. It's now time to start to finish the conquest of everything that needs to be done. And the Jews are ready and raring to go. And they say, Mi ale lanu el aknani batchila. Who's going to fight the Knani? But at the very end of Sefer Shoftim, Mi ale lanu batchila lelachim b'knei binyamin. You see, that means dramatic, isn't it? Who would go and kill our own people, not somebody else's people? And to my mind, these psukim stitch together the entire goal of Sefer. The desperation of Sefer Shoftim. I don't mean to bum anybody out. Maybe it won't come tomorrow. I mean, to tell you every shiur is going to be depressing. Hopefully we'll get some good points also. But ultimately, Sefer Shoftim was written by a person that wants to prove the idea of failure. Global, or at least national failure, which transfers things from the potential to conquer Israel to an issue where they have to murder each other in order to survive more. And that's sad, actually. That's quite sad. And that's why these two chronological stories... They have to murder Binyamin. They have to murder out Binyamin in order to expunge Sodom and Amorah from their midst. So they've gone to the point where one of their tribes is as bad as Sodom and Amorah, and the other tribes now have to use all their great forces to conquer themselves, to destroy themselves. It's terrible. No, that's true, and there's something to be said about whether they did it right or whether they did it wrong. But those two psukim are day and night. They're Vayihi Or and Vayihi Choshech. And they tie the same, and everything else that comes between is neatly sandwiched between those two psukim. Everything else feeds that goal. Something happens in Sefer Shoftim which ties together the idea of total and complete potential to total and complete despair. I'm sorry, Shandy, I cut you off. Now let's get to the issue of the need for a king. Now let's get to this weird story about color. What's the issue with color? I want to take you back in time a little bit. Why is color's name not mentioned here? And why repeat the exact same story that was told in Yoshua? What's with this story? The first thing we need to know about color and Yehuna is his origins. The first time we meet him, of course, is with the Meraglim. And, of course, the heroes of the Meraglim story are none other than Yeshua and Kalev. Everybody would say that. I would disagree. I would ask you to read, it's at the very top of the first section in this, in the first cutout section. Vayisaf, this is in Perek Yud Gimel, not during the punishment phase. This is the phase where they're trying to tell the Jews what's going on. And the Meragim are telling bad news, and you would think that Yehoshua and Kaleb are telling the good news, except that's not what happens. Vayisafu lo vayomer banu el eretz, they said, they told the people we came to the land, Asher shlachtanu, that you sent us to. Gam zvat chalav devashi, it's a nice place to live. Vezev priyan, look at the beautiful fruits. Ephes, not worth a thing. Azaham, they're a terrible, great nation. Hayoshebar, the Arim Surot Gedolomo, they're these gigantic cities, we'll never conquer them. Adam Yilidea Anak, keep in mind, Yilidea Anak, Ra'ilu Sham, Amalek Yosheber, it's a Negev, the Amalek live in the south, Akipia Yibusi Bahar, they live in the mountains, Bakhane Yosheb Alayam, Alayadan, Vayahas Kalev et Aam El Moshe, Vayomar Alen Aleh. That's it. Chapter ends. There is only one person telling everybody else to shut up, and that is none other than Kaleb, not Yehoshua. Now it's true, when God does a sum up in the next chapter, which I didn't print out, he's grouped together as Kaleb and Yehoshua are trying to save things. But that's after punishment has already started. That's after the punishment phase. At the moment that the stress is taking place and these guys are holding up this fruit and then taking pictures of giants and murder and terrible things, the only person stumping for success is not Yehoshua, Kaleb. So I ask you a question. If you're Moshe Rabbeinu and you had to choose a leader for Bnei Yisrael to take over, you really have one of two choices, not one of one choice. Your one of two choices are Kaleb Yehoshua. And you have to ask the question, why Yehoshua?
From God told me that's the answer.
You want to know something? You're absolutely right, and I want to take it to, I want to show you how right you are. And unfortunately, I didn't print it out. In Sefer Bamidbar, I don't have a printout here. If you have a Tanakh, look at Sefer Bamidbar. There's a four-word sentence which everybody ignores because it goes so quick that people don't realize the power in this little tiny sentence. It's where God tells Moshe that it's time to go. And Moshe says, I want you to appoint a new leader. And God says, okay, it's going to be Yehoshua. Because God says it's going to be Yehoshua. But what's something very interesting happens in that Sefer Bamidbar? I'm sorry you don't have the printouts. I don't want to take the time to find it. But what it says is, Vayomer Moshe El Hashem Lemor. Listen to those words. Because you always skip those words. I always know those are the boring words. You always, Vayomer Hashem Moshe Lemor, Tzavet B'nei Yisrael. Then you get to the juicy part. People always forget the first few sentences. Listen to the words again, because they only appear once in all the Torah. Vayomer Moshe El Hashem Lemor, which means Moshe is commanding God to appoint a new leader. There's this tension that's going on there. It's can you imagine such a thing? Think about what that means. I'll tell you, God, who I want to be the leader. Then, by the way, when Hashem says it's going to be Yehoshua, retroactively, you have to figure that Moshe does not want Yehoshua. It's not the only way to understand that, but it certainly makes sense. If Hashem says, you've got to take Yehoshua, and the pasuk beforehand says, Moshe says, I want to tell you, God, who to appoint?
Lord, I didn't get that.
You don't get this tension?
No, I just heard him say, appoint someone.
You know what? Let me read the words. It's not as dramatic if I don't read the words. So let me find the, I think it's in Chafal, Chafet. Hold on, sorry. Oh, here it is. God told him he's got to die. Why? Kashem Arifem Pim Midbar Tzimdi, listen to me, you hit the rock, etc. There's already something weird going on. That's a weird pasuk. It's a pasuk that implies a certain confrontation. It's God is telling, Moshe is telling God what to do, which is weird. Now listen, Yifkod Adonai, let God establish Elohim Rukol B'chol Basar Shal Eidah, Asher Yetzei Lifneihem, I want to send somebody to go before them, V'asher Yavo Lifneihem, and somebody to go for them, V'asher Yotziim, V'asher Yivyeim, V'lo Tia Adat Hashem, Katzon Eim Lehem Ruah, I want somebody to go to war, somebody to come back from war, I want somebody. What's missing from Moshe's statement is what? Who? Who? At the very least, he couldn't make up his mind. But at the very worst, and then Hashem says, "Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Kach lecha Yehoshua ben Nun, Ish asher ruach bo, v'samata v'hamadata v'natata, and do it in front of the whole people, etc., etc." There's certainly a tension going on. I can't prove that Moshe wanted somebody else, But I can think of right away somebody that Moshe would have wanted. It's not Kalev. Who do you think Moshe would have wanted to be the next leader to succeed him?
His son.
In fact, his sons disappear from the story, which is an interesting medrash, by the way. Think about this medrash carefully. Moshe's had enough of the people. He can't handle it enough. So they appoint 70 people. There's new Beit Din, there's new Zkenim, and they start to prophesy. Two of these prophets, Eldon and Medah, go into the Machaneh and start to bring prophecy to the people. Let's make it democratic. Vayarat Hanar Lagid LeMoshe, Eldad and Medad in Nabiim BaMachaneh, Vayomer Yoshua Kilaim. Yoshua wants to throw them Eldad and Medad in jail right away. Why? Because you have these leaders who are stumping for the Jewish people. The Nar, however, can't be colored. So Chazal tell us, and that's a message that it is his son. It was Gershom. Oh, because it can't be. If you say Vayomer Anar El Yoshua, El Moshe, Vayomer Yoshua Moshe Klaim, they wouldn't have used Nar for one person. They wouldn't have used the Nar if they were going to use Yoshua for his name. He's one of the people referred to as Nar. But you can't read these two psukim right together and have Yoshua named and then have an unnamed Nar and think that the Nar is Yoshua. It just doesn't work out. It doesn't sound right. The Nar is somebody else. And Chazal immediately picked up on this and they come up with a message. It was none other than Gershom. And I'll tell you why. Who would be most upset? Who would be the person who would be the most upset about the new leaders of Israel going in and talking to the people and prophesizing for the people face to face? What is, I think, the message of Chazal is quite clear, which is Yoshua's son. What about, by the way, Moshe's son, who, by the way, was not a prophet, who did not become one of the 70 escaped? Moshe's sons, Eleazar and Gershom, disappear. Interestingly enough, by the way, Gershom shows up at the end of Sefer Shoftim. When we're talking about Levim, which is the coming. But aside from the fact that Moshe may or may not want it of Yoshua, there's a very strange. What I showed to you from the story of the Meraglim is that if I were there and I saw the Meraglim happen, I wanted to pick the leader of the people that wants to bring Eretz Israel in. Yoshua certainly is a good choice. But wouldn't Kalev be a better choice? Kalev was the one who said, we gotta go. Yoshua said nothing. Nothing. He wasn't there. Shows up afterwards, things cool down, Moshe gets angry, God shows up, Yoshua's there. I'm not trying to belittle Yoshua, he's a great leader. But Kalev's the one who put his life on the line to say, no, we've got to go in, don't listen to these people, it's just me. Another interesting thing happens. Yaakov gives a bracha to Bnei Israel at the very end, he's one of the tribes. And I won't take it inside now, but it's fascinating to look at. The two biggest, juiciest brachot are Yosef and Yehud. Both of them talk about kingship or rulership. Yosef kod nazir achav. But Yehuda, Shevet Yehuda, is lo yasur shevet, what is it, mechokek miben and adonecha, yishtachavu lecha, they'll bow down to you. Both of them, by Yaakov seems to be a little unclear who should be the leader. And of course, Yehuda really was the first of the leaders of the brothers. That's why the brothers said, had you, Yehuda, told us not to sell Yosef, we wouldn't have done it. And Yehuda takes the trappings of a king when he goes down and has the children, Aaron, Onan, and he actually sets up shop in what's the place that he lived in when they rented in Mitzrayim? Goshen. It was Yehuda that goes down to set up. Yehuda goes first. There's this conflict. There's this constant Yosef-Yehuda conflict. But if you take a look at the brachot at the end of Zot HaBracha, Yosef gets, which means Moshe is giving him the blessing, Yosef gets almost the same blessing. Kod Nizir Achav. What is Yehuda's blessing? Yehuda's blessing disappears. Let me read you his blessing. It's a little bit of a letdown. If I was Shevet Yehuda, I think I'd be a little upset. If we go to Sefer Dvarim, let me read you from Zot HaBracha, and everybody, I mean, it's a little depressing. Where is it? Let's see. I don't even think they get a full sentence. Where's the bracha? Zot HaBracha. Yamin, Levi, Yehuda. The Zot of Yehuda, and this is for Yehuda. Vayomer Shema Hashem Kol Yehuda. God shall listen to the voice of Yehuda. Ve'el Amo Tivieno. He should bring him back to his people. Yadav Rav Lo. His hand should be great. Ve'ezer Mitzarav Tiyeh. He should be a help for his enemies. And compare that to what Yaakov said to Yehuda. That's an incredible letdown. If it was just by itself and out of context, so you could answer, you could say, no. Moshe had different goals, and the bracha were different purposes. There's no reason why you should give him the same bracha. I would accept that argument, except the fact that Yosef gets the same bracha. Kod nazir achav, you'll be a leader of your brothers. He keeps the bracha of leadership. Yehuda, if it's there, it's mighty hidden. Now Chazal do take out the trappings of kingship from that, don't get me wrong. But literally, the words, I mean, it's like, it's a letdown, it's an anti-climax for Sheva Yehuda. And now, I'll finish off the final issue with Kalev, and then we'll understand what that whole story is with Asa jumping off her donkey. It's in Dvarim Perek Aleph, which is the second cutout of the page. In Dvarim Perek Aleph is where Moshe is going through and retelling the story of the Meraglim, among other stories. The Shoftim, the Meraglim, all the things that happened that kept Bnei Israel wandering around the desert 40 years. So he retells the Meraglim story, but he tells it a little bit different. Now, we could spend weeks on this as it is, but I'll just tell you without proving to you the points here, and you'll have to just bear with me. I know some of these things need to be proved, but... Vayifnu vayalu hahara. So they send the Meraglim up to the Hara. Vayavo ad Nachal Eshkol. Nachal Eshkol is none other than the Nachal right below Hebron. Right? We know that because who were Avram's friends in Hebron when he was sending up by Shabayon and Re? Who were the people? Avi Aner, Avi Eshkol. Eshkol was one of the major leaders of Hebron area. Which means, according to this, Meraglim did not go everywhere in Eretz Israel. And by the way, I can prove that. I know this measures how do they wander around Eretz Israel 40 days, the mountains jumped, etc. They never wandered around Eretz Israel at all. The pasuk is very clear. They went up to Nachal Eshkol. They had one purpose, which was to do battle with Nachal Eshkol, to take, again, I'm going to just give you these as facts. I can prove these things. The Meraglim did battle. Al Odot Shekarav ben Nachal. I can prove these things, but it will take too long. We could spend an hour or two on this. I could prove to you, for now, just bear with me and sort of take it as a fact, although it's very unfair what I'm doing to you. They had to go only up to Nachal Eshkol. They were to do battle in Nachal Eshkol. By the way, they went to the field to cut off the grapes. We know exactly what season they went in. They went in the end of the grape picking season. That's like going into somebody's house when they come home with their paycheck and say, thank you, I'll take that, and walking out the door. You'd have the same effect here that you would have there. So there is a battle, by the way. I can prove it textually. The text actually proves that there's a battle. They go just to Hebron, by Yirag Luota, and they find out how to conquer Hebron, by Yikumi Pri Adamat Arts, by Yoredo Alano. They go right back there. They go right back to the Negev, deep Negev, Har Sinai, or Kadesh Barnea. By Yashuvo Otano Adavar, by Yom Utova Arts, Hashem, Asher Natan, Hashem Okeno Natalano. No bad news is brought back, because this is a different purpose. In Yireh Ish Vanashim Ha'elu Dor Harazeh, I've skipped a few psukim, by the way, to get to the bad part. At the Aris Kavah, so they do something bad and God starts to punish them. Now we're on Pasuk Lamed Hey. Asher Nishpati Lavotem Zulati Kalev Ben Yifuneh. The only one who's going to see Eretz Yisrael, not Kalev and Yoshua, by the way. Once again, the focus is on Kalev, but something else is going on. Zulati Kalev Ben Yifuneh Hu Yirena Velo Etain Et Aretz Asher Darach Ba. And he will get the land that he stepped on. And again, you have to take it as a proof, and I haven't proved it to you. Take it as an axiom. The only land they stepped on was Nachal Eshkol and the Ir Hebron. That was the only land they went to. They went up, they did battle, they figured out how to conquer the city, but they didn't conquer it. They were meraglim it, they spied it out, and they went back home. So according to that, he's saying the land that they stepped on, that the Kalev came back from, that's the land you have to give to him and his sons, i.e. he gets Hebron. But now something very weird is going on in Sefer Yoshua. Please take a look at Sefer Yoshua and Perek Yudalev, which is right. This is the fourth item down. Vayikshu bnei Yudal Yoshua. Bnei Yehuda comes to Yoshua. Bagila. Vayomer lo Kalev ben Yifuneh Hakinizi. Kalev ben Yifuneh shows up and he says, Atayadata, you know good and well, Yoshua, et davar asher diber al Moshe ish Elohim, that which God commanded Moshe to do, alodot v'alodotecha b'kadesh Barnea, on what happened and on things that happened in Kadesh Barnea. Ben arba'im shana anochi. Now here's a weird story. I was only 40 years old. B'shlach Moshe eved Hashem oti mikadesh Barnea. By the way, B'shlach oti, who seems to be left out of the picture? You, Yoshua, weren't even there. And the truth is, he's not lying. God ignores Yoshua here in Sefer Dvarim. And the actual telling of the story, the emphasis without question on color. The Ragelot Aris, V'ashuv oto davar, and I brought back the word kasher im livavi. You sense the tension here? Is a chutzpah. Or is it chutzpah? Because it's telling the truth. Is it chutzpahdik if you're going to the leader of the Jewish people who's taken the leadership because he was the great Meragel who came back with a good word? And yet, you're telling the truth, it wasn't you, Yeshua, it was me, buddy. Now let's take a look at what goes on. Va'achai asher alu imi, imasu et lav livava'an. And my brothers who went with me, not with us,
with me, they tricked the people, they melted the people. Va'anochi, and me, mileti acharei Hashem v'kafa. You get the sense? It's very emotional here, this confrontation. And by the way, Yeshua doesn't, Kalev doesn't go up. Look at the first words in this section. Kalev doesn't go up. All of who goes up to make this statement to Yeshua? All of Bnei Yehuda goes up to Yehoshua, the king of the Jewish people right now, the leader of the Jewish people, to say, let's get things straight. But let's remember how things really went. Vayishavam Moshe b'yom ahu lemor, im lo ha'aretz asher dachar raglecha ba, the land that you stepped on here, l'chatz yiyeh v'nachalal v'nachal olam. I'm going to give it to Kalev, or after, kimileti acharei Hashem, because I listen to him. God let me live 45 years. Atam, skip me a line, and now I'm 45 years. Look to Pasuk Yud Aleph, it's towards the end of like the 7th line now. Odeni Hayom Chazak, I am still strong. Kasher Biyom Shalach Oti Moshe, I'm as strong as I was when I went 40 years ago. Kekochi Az, my strength then. Kekochi Ata, I'm a young guy. I'm a powerful leader. Menuchama, to war, and now remember the words of Moshe when he wants people to be appointed to take charge of Jewish people. Latseit l'tne'am v'lavo l'tne'am. Look what Kalev says. Latseit v'lavo, to go and to come, to lead the people. V'atatznali et harazeh. First question that you have to ask is why does he, I have a question. Do you think Yeshua studied Sefer Torah? Do you think he doesn't know that God promised and told Moshe that you must give this land to Kalev? So why? The only thing that makes sense is that Kalev is showing up with all his people to say, I want you to give me the land. And this is at, you know, towards the end of Yoshua's life. Is it Yoshua not giving the land? You don't have to demand something which is yours. Look at the words. Don't you remember what happened that God promised? Moshe promised me this land. You have to give it to me. Not only does he say that, you can feel the tension between him. He also, look at what he's saying. I went. I came back. And I am strong. I could lead the Jewish people in war still. I.e. Yoshua, you are an old dude. You're now 110 years old. You're closing out your life. I am as strong now as I was back then. We never know how late Kalev lived. He might have lived 150. Probably not. Maybe 120. Maybe had another 20 years to go. But if we assume that he's not lying, his kochi ata, his kochi az. How many people? See the tension here? Moshe gives it to Yeshua. But Kalev is probably thinking, not only Kalev, but all of Bnei Yehuda after they hear Moshe's little bracha, which cuts them out of the kingship totally. And I mean, it's like, you know, it's like one of those things where you're a manager and you want to get that job, but you get like passed over for the other guy. And like the next day, very often what you do is like leave the company because, you know, once you get passed over, you pretty much had it. Time to go somewhere else because you knew it was yours. It was yours. You deserved it. I'm not even talking about somebody who has an ego who thinks something's theirs when they're not. It's hard to say that Kalev deserved it any less than Yeshua. Not that Yeshua wasn't a great guy and spiritual guy, but certainly Kalev is up there. Certainly Shevet Yehuda, the first ones through the Dead Sea, certainly they stand up against Shevet Yosef. And now that Yeshua's life is running out, Kalev is going to do something very interesting. And this is a concept that I've been teaching throughout the class, which means you can't have a king unless you have a son who's a king. Something I've mentioned over and over. The whole story of the daughter and Kalev. Kalev essentially takes this boy, who's a relative, and makes him what? By marrying him off to his daughter. Just like David would have been married Michal to become the son of Shaul, had it worked out. So essentially this story was being repeated twice. Once here, during when Yeshua is still alive and Sefer Yeshua, to show the tension that's going on between the two tribes. But look at how the Sefer starts. Sefer, let's go back now to Sefer Shulchan. Look how it starts. Sefer Yoshua starts Vayihi. If we go to the beginning of Sefer Yoshua, it starts at... Sorry, go ahead.
Moshe's brother left Yosef offending and took and diminished Yehuda.
Yeah.
Okay, that's your thesis. And yet, and now the Yoshua is from Yosef.
That's correct. Absolutely right.
So Moshe is pushing Yehoshua.
Yeah, he's pushing, and Yosef with him. Shevet Yosef and Yehoshua.
Okay.
He is.
So
oh, so you're asking me why?
Me to find a suggestion. That Moshe really wanted Kalev.
No, actually, in my opinion, Moshe wanted his own son. Because, again, the only way you get to be the king is if your son takes over as a king.
So in order to set up the Levitical tribe of kingship, and by the way, it would happen some hundreds of years later, right? It would not be. Ladies, there's always, it didn't work out. It wouldn't have worked out then either. And it didn't work out with Eli, and it didn't work out with Shmuel and his sons either. Every time a lady tries up to stand up to be the Melech, it falls apart. No question about it. No, I'm not saying that he wanted Kalev. I don't think so. I think it was, if it wasn't going to be his son, I think he was happy to take Yehoshua. Yehoshua was this nar. He worked with Yehoshua. They had a tight relationship. He was a general. No, I don't think that the tension was because he didn't, because he wanted Kalev. I think because he wanted to give it to his children, just like any father wanted to his children. We could argue that point, but one thing is clear. Regardless of who Moshe wanted to be the king, I know Kalev wanted to be the king. I have no doubt in my mind who Shevet Yehuda wanted to get the nod. It's to me absolutely clear from these words. And if you take a look at Sefer Yehoshua, Yehoshua essentially starts off with, listen, Vayihi acharei mot Moshe, Eved Hashem. Moshe is dead, and now we've got to go to the next step. Because Moshe didn't leave a descendant, we now have to start anew the idea of establishing the future of the Jewish people. And now I will take you again to Shoftim. Look how Shoftim begins. It's a mirror image of that, which means it's the same old, it's deja vu all over again. Look at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. Vayihi acharei mot Yehoshua. Starts the same way. Why does it start chronologically out of order? Because they want to make a point. Yehoshua's dead. And now essentially you have the same problem that Moshe had. We have Moshe died. And this is Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun's famous question. You may have heard it. I know you were at that he gave in Tina. And I never got a chance to answer the question. I wanted to go up and talk to him about it, but everybody swamped him. His question was, why do you have a weird story? Remember, who does Yehoshua, according to Medrash, who does Yehoshua wind up marrying? Rachav Azona, right? Marries a prostitute who's already, according to Medrash, does he marry her, but according to Medrash, she was the Jewish person, the girl who got taken from the Jewish people 40 years ago. There are no kids. There are no kids.
I thought their kids were supposed to go to 7 years.
Yehoshua, again, textually, Yehoshua leaves no successor. Not only does he have no kids, okay, so Yehoshua never had kids, but Moshe didn't have kids, but at least he did what? Went to the successor. Not one place in Sefer Yehoshua do you find Yehoshua appointed successor. The prime goal of a king or of a ruler is to pass on the rulership to the next level. Then what do you have to do? So Rabbi Yoel said, I don't understand why Yehoshua did never pass down the descendant. Why did he not choose a ruler? What? It could be. And yet I want to actually answer a little differently. He did appoint the ruler. You know who? We don't know, we never will, and it doesn't make a difference. Because the next leader after Yehoshua was not from Shevet Yosef, it was the son not of Yehoshua, it was the son of Kalev and Kuna. Yehoshua, it's not that Yehoshua didn't want to appoint a successor. He wanted to. Shevet Yosef, eminent, appoint the successor of Malchut Yosef. Except he failed. I think the fact that he never appointed anybody, I think Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun has a little bit wrong. It's not that he never appointed anybody, he probably did appoint. How could it be? You could say that he never appointed anybody, sort of like David sort of avoids the whole thing. You could say that. But absolutely, it's certainly possible. I prefer to say that he probably did have somebody. There must have been somebody who came over. It's like the love, you know, Mahavgil, and I'm not trying to make fun of Lubavitch here. It's like, you know, you get to the point where you find that you're not able. I don't think Kashmir Lubavitch Rebbe was not an egotist. He's a close friend of my Rav. He was a close friend of my Rav. Tremendous Tom Kacha. But I guess you get to a certain point where you just don't want to appoint a leader because you don't believe that anybody can do the job after you. Or you hope maybe the Messiah will come. Or who knows what you hope. And then by the time it's there to appoint the leader, it's already too late. That may be true with Yehoshua. It may be true. But I want to say I could take it a step further. Even if you say he did appoint the ruler, it doesn't matter. Because in the first pasuk of Sefer Shoftim, it doesn't make a difference who he picks. Because the leader of the Jewish people is not his descendant or his pick at all. Who gets to pick the ruler of the Jewish people? Kalev ben Yefuneh. Shevet Yehuda becomes preeminent. Becomes preeminent in Sefer Shoftim. And by the way, it explains why the focus on Shevet Yehuda. Who shall go up first to make war at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim? Yehuda. Who will go up to make war at the end of Sefer Shoftim? For evil purposes, for terrible purposes, but it's still Shevet Yehuda. Because the author, as again I'll prove in little chunks as we go on, the Sefer Shmuel, who's writing it knowing about this Yosef Yehuda problem. He knows about David Melech. I don't know, we don't know when exactly, we know Shmuel died after he picked David to be the new ruler. He kicked out Shaul, although he never got it, no, Shaul wasn't being kicked out, but he certainly anointed David. I am willing to say that Shmuel wrote this Sefer of Shoftim after he already picked Shevet Yehuda to be the new rulers, And he's trying to explain that the tension that's going on with Shevet Shoftim was the total lack. He really started it off. Where's the king? Why not appoint the king? But the truth is, I think it's a little bit deeper than that. They did appoint the king, but nobody accepted it. Nobody accepted it. There was a king, which is in essence a rebellion. All right, it didn't come to fighting. They didn't, Shevet Yehuda didn't go up and fight Shevet Yosef. Yoshua just backed down and disappeared, and Otniel ben Kenaz became the next ruler. But certainly it's insurrection. Absolutely. Yeah, we're going to do it the way we will. Our tribe will rule with your people. Oh, they set up a king. They tried to. The first king, in fact, of Shevet Shoftim is Kalev and his son, Otniel ben Kenaz. Father ruled.